number 2. When I recorded audio letter 26 last month on September 30, I alerted you to the fact that Soviet submarines were on their way in great numbers to surround the United States. A military confrontation was definitely underway, and I warned you that the possibility of war itself could not be ignored. Only the previous weekend, the Soviet Union had abruptly expelled all Western fishing trawlers from the Barents Sea, where the big Murmansk naval base is located. On Tuesday, September 27, the secret space battle of the Harvest Moon ended the existence of the American moon base in Copernicus Crater. And by that day, both the Barents Sea and also the Sea of Okhotsk off the Kamchatka Peninsula were swarming with Soviet submarines. While these military developments were going on behind the scenes, Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko delivered a veiled ultimatum to the United States during a very harsh speech at the United Nations. And that evening, at Gromyko's demand, a sudden and unexpected meeting was held at the White House between Gromyko, Jimmy Carter, and Secretary of State Cyrus Vance. Last month, I told you what Gromyko told Carter in very blunt language. And the very next day, the two huge Soviet submarine fleets left their staging areas to converge on the United States. Since NATO regards the deployment to sea of the Soviet submarine force as a major warning signal of impending conflict, the situation was potentially very grave indeed. So I warned you, based on information from my own intelligence sources, that by October 7, if not before, the United States would be surrounded along our east, west, and Gulf coasts by the Soviet submarine fleet. On October 5, early this month, Vice Admiral William Reed, commander of our Atlantic Fleet Naval Surface Forces, revealed at the Southeast Sea Power Symposium in Atlanta, Georgia, the fact that Soviet submarines, together with many surface ships, were present in great numbers along our Atlantic and Gulf coasts. And, he said, they were close enough to destroy American cities in a nuclear war. He added that in any long war with the Soviet Union, America would be at a grave disadvantage because of the size and effectiveness of the Soviet Navy. The next day, October 6, a naval spokesman in San Diego was reported by a local radio station to have said that large numbers of Soviet submarines had been sighted in the Pacific, also heading in our direction. On the morning of October 7, 1977, my own reports indicated that the Pacific Armada was about 700 miles west of San Francisco at its closest point and was spread out over an area of ocean 1,000 miles long north to south and 200 miles deep. The Atlantic Armada was some 1,600 miles from New York City at its closest point, spread out over a similar area of ocean. At that point, the Pacific Armada was slowing down to enable the Atlantic Armada to close in to a similar distance. In the Gulf of Mexico, meanwhile, the fleet of 29 submarines, which were already on station when I recorded audio letters 26, were simply staying there, waiting. By the evening of October 9, the Pacific Armada was on station, in battle formation, spread out along our entire west coast at a distance of 400 miles. The Atlantic Armada was just over 500 miles from New York City at its closest point, but still had the job of spreading out to parallel the east coastline. While this was being done, the fleet west of our shores began injecting a radiochemical poison into our air by means of powerful fluorocarbon dispensers. This technique of radiological warfare is exactly the same as I described 1 year ago in audio letter 17 in connection with the Soviet submarine confrontation that occurred at that time. But this time, the formulation involves both plutonium, which is radioactive, and zirconium. As I revealed in audio letter 17, this combination is what causes so-called Legionnaire's disease, and I'll have more to say about that in a moment. Early that day, October 9th, British Foreign Minister David Owen left London unexpectedly for a hurried two-day trip to Moscow. The stated cover for the trip was to discuss Rhodesia and trade matters, but Owen was actually going to Moscow to capitulate. In spite of all the things Great Britain has been trying to do to stand up to the Kremlin, the Soviet particle beam breakthrough, and America's loss in this decisive race has made the situation untenable. The evening of the following day, Vice President Mondale was recalled to Washington out of a Columbus Day parade in San Francisco. The crisis was deepening. By midday October 12th, the peak threat from the Soviet submarine fleet was in progress. In the west, the fleet had moved to within 250 miles from shore. In the east, the Soviets had moved to within less than 150 miles of New York City, and along our Atlantic, Pacific, and Gulf coastlines, Soviet submarines were essentially halted, in position for attack at any moment. The Western fleet continued injecting radiochemical poisons into our air, including, for a while, strontium 90. There were fresh reports of fireballs over Russia that day, and the same day it was announced that Leonid Brezhnev will soon visit Britain due to the progress made during Owen's weekend visit. Secretary of Defense Harold Brown, in Europe for talks with our NATO allies, now headed for Yugoslavia, as had been announced. According to my own information, a high United States government official conveyed America's capitulation to the Soviet Union on October 14 through intermediary channels. I have not been able to confirm the identity of this official, but the fact that Brown was in Yugoslavia on that day may not be coincidence. In any event, the Soviet threat of war served its intended purpose as well. It placed the United States in a position in which any attempt to retaliate against the Soviets for destroying our moon base would have been suicidal. In particular, it ensured that there would be no American attempt to interfere with the Soviet moon mission, which took place during this period. In this respect, it was a Cuban Missile Crisis all over again, but with the roles of America and Russia reversed. The Kremlin are well aware that the situation now confronting the real rulers of America is totally new to them, and they really do not know what to do. For the first time, they no longer have an invisible ace up their sleeve to make Russia toe the line. But the Soviet display of military power and readiness to use it made the controlled Carter administration cave in, just as Khrushchev had caved in under the same pressures 15 years ago. The Russians are well known for their ability to win games of chess, and they were not to be bluffed. As a result, America surrendered to the Soviet Union on October 14, 1977, on terms I will reveal in topic number 3. And the Soviet acceptance of that surrender was indicated on October 15, as the bulk of the Soviet submarine fleets turned away from America's shores and began heading for home. By October 16, all but two of the submarines along our Gulf Coast were already heading back into Cuban waters, where they were congregated along the north coast, east of Camagüey, by October 18. The eastern and western armadas were far out to sea by then, except for five each that stayed on station near our shores. On October 17, with the Soviet Navy safely out of its threatening posture, NATO began its own two-week naval exercises in the Atlantic. But the 12 Soviet submarines, which had stayed behind along our shores, continued to spew plutonium-zirconium poisons into our atmosphere to produce Legionnaire's disease without any interference. Legionnaire's disease, like so-called swine flu, is an artificial disease caused by radiological warfare. My confidential intelligence sources enabled me to warn that the government's swine flu program was a hoax to cover up the effects of radiological warfare in America as early as April 1976 in Audio Letter 11, just after the program was announced by President Gerald Ford. And in audio letter 17, 1 year ago this month, I was able to tell the full story of the swine flu hoax, Legionnaire's disease, and additional strange illnesses that were cropping up at that time. At this time last year, the Soviet Union had begun a program of experimental plutonium cloud attacks against America's population, using a formulation that was intended to produce a swine flu-like illness. But that project was never as effective as desired, and more recently, they began experimenting with the plutonium-zirconium formulation that produces so-called Legionnaire's disease. This had been tested first at the American Legion Convention in July 1976, where 180 people became ill and 28 died. Recent cloud attacks by Soviet submarines have shown that this is a more effective poison than the earlier one, as Legionnaire's disease is showing up increasingly nationwide. As I explained in audio letter 17, Legionnaire's disease is basically a form of radiation sickness caused deliberately at will by secret radiological warfare by the Soviet Union. Recently, it has been announced that a peculiar pneumonia bacterium has been linked with Legionnaire's disease, but this is only a complication. The basic cause which weakens the body to permit this bacterial complication is the Soviet radiochemical poison in our air. Not everyone falls ill who is exposed to the poison in the low concentrations currently found in our air. Those who are in good basic health, who get sufficient rest and proper nutrition, have the best chance of avoiding its effects. They are also the ones who are most likely to survive if they do contract Legionnaire's disease. The mortality rate is about 15%, the same now as it was in the first big outbreak in Philadelphia. Antibiotics can affect the bacterial complication, but in no way affect the basic cause, which is radiological. So far, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta claims that Legionnaire's disease has been reported by 22 states and the District of Columbia. Some spokesmen are now referring to it as, quote, atypical pneumonia, unquote. But call it what you will, it is spreading. Many doctors still are not familiar with it. So here is a list of the symptoms which accompany Legionnaire's disease. Typically, it begins with a general malaise and headaches. Within a day, this is followed by a rapidly rising fever, which may reach levels of from 102 to 105 degrees, together with chills. A hacking cough, stomach ache, nausea, and diarrhea are common, sometimes including bleeding. Yet, as severe as it is not contagious. That is, passed from one person to another. Everyone contracts it from the same source, namely the air we breathe. Not everyone gets all the symptoms. Different people seem to be affected somewhat differently. In small children, I'm informed that it can show up as an especially severe form of croup due to the strong effect of the plutonium-zirconium poison in the air passage of the throat. It may be that this is the reason for the unusually severe outbreaks of croup now occurring in some of our northern states, which state health officials are at a loss to explain. My friends, we in the United States, together with people in certain parts of Canada and Mexico, are the victims of a spreading atomic plague. It's produced by undeclared warfare, radiological warfare, on the part of the Soviet Union to demoralize and weaken our will to resist the final takeover. Thanks to the surrender to the Kremlin by the Carter administration this month, it's not the Soviet Union that will be laying down its arms, but we ourselves. Topic number 3. In a news conference on September 29, 1977, President Carter told reporters that there was no prospect of any immediate agreement on a second Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, or SALT II. 2 days earlier, Soviet Foreign Minister Gromyko had denounced the sorry state of Soviet-American relations in very harsh terms and had demanded that a new SALT accord be agreed upon, quote, without any delay, unquote. And in a hastily called meeting that evening, Gromyko made it clear that the Kremlin, having put the secret American moon base out of operation that day, was now going to start cracking the whip. The Carter's response was more one of shock than one of immediate total capitulation, and therefore the Soviet submarines began moving toward America within hours after Gromyko left the White House. The surrender by the United States on October 14 involved America's acceptance of Soviet demands for a new SALT II agreement that will effectively disarm America while leaving Soviet armaments free to expand and develop still further. The only concession granted by Brezhnev to Carter is a slight extension of time to allow the Carter administration to prepare the way for America's acceptance of the treaty to strip us militarily. The extent of the radical shift in favor of the Soviet Union concerning disarmament was revealed on October 19 at the United Nations. There, in a committee away from the limelight, but visible to key members of the world's diplomatic community, major statements were made by both the United States and the Soviet Union. The American statement expressed our willingness to cooperate and declared that an agreement on a whole range of issues may be just around the corner. The Soviet statement spoke of closing the arms race and said Russia is ready to proceed with, quote, drastic disarmament measures, unquote. And the American delegate, Mr. Fisher, expanded on the fact that he now found a new sense of vigor and urgency, stressing that the world is experiencing a fundamental shift in thinking about disarmament. My friends, worldwide fundamental shifts in thinking about anything do not happen without there being a reason. And that reason, as I have told you, is the end of the American moon base and the exclusive possession by the Soviet Union of the new particle beam super weapon. The following day, details began leaking out about the shape of the proposed SALT II accord, and it will continue to be the subject of heavy news coverage and debate. SALT II contains tremendous concessions by the United States, with none of significance by the Soviet Union even on its face. For example, Jimmy Carter canceled the B-1 bomber, much to the Kremlin's delight, with a silly argument that the cruise missile would replace it. The cruise missile, my friends, is more vulnerable to Soviet air defenses than the B-1 would have been. But now, SALT II will even put the cruise missile out of business by restricting its range sufficiently to force our old slow B-52s to get so close to Russia in an attack that they can be shot down by the vast Soviet air defense system. In addition, the United States will agree not to provide cruise missiles or the technology to build them to our NATO allies, to whom the cruise missile could be very valuable. In return for this, America is to settle for a Soviet pledge about their supersonic backfire bomber, the rough equivalent of our B-1 bomber. According to NATO intelligence, the Soviet Union is already flying more than 400 backfires. In other words, they already have a larger force of brand-new, supersonic, strategic backfires than our force of 20-year-old, subsonic, tired-out B-52s. And what's more, the newest version has even greater range than our B-52, and Soviet plants are churning out more backfires every month. But the Carter administration has settled for a promise from the Soviets not to start producing backfires any faster than they are doing already. What's more, the Kremlin has simply given its word that backfires will not be deployed in a strategic manner despite their strategic capability. In return for that, we agreed not to count their backfires at all as strategic bombers, thereby exempting them from the limits of weaponry spelled out in SALT II. And we agree to trust them, not requiring verification of any kind. Can you imagine that as serious as these matters are, They're overshadowed by the seriousness of what is left out altogether from the SALT II proposals. They say not a word about the radiological warfare weapons, which are being used right now on the United States. They say nothing at all about anti-satellite weapons, despite their disastrous implications, and despite the fact that even the Defense Department admits they are now operational in the Soviet arsenal. SALT II would do nothing to restrict the use of microwave weapons on humans, which, as I reveal in Audio Letter 20 for January 1977, is also being done by the Soviet Union. And beam weapons, particularly the particle beam, which is the exclusive property of Russia now, are ignored altogether. Thus, for example, our strategic missile forces are rapidly being neutralized, while those of the Soviet Union are preserved. Our early warning satellites, which we depend upon to warn us of any attack by the Soviet Union, are being destroyed by Cosmos interceptor satellites. And if we were to launch our missiles, properly deployed Soviet particle beams could be used to destroy the warheads in flight. The rough equivalents in missiles that the Soviet Union now seems ready to write into the SALT II Accord therefore means nothing. What is actually being inaugurated now is the total disarmament of America. Those who are using their influence to have America accept the SALT II agreement claim that by granting the Soviet Union such horrendous concessions, we will take away any Soviet incentive to go to war. But, my friends, this is the intellectual way to say better red than dead. But if the Alice in Wonderland world of unreality that is built into SALT II is accepted, then we as a nation will be both red and dead. It has taken 200 years to undo the structure for freedom and prosperity that was devised by our founding fathers. And more than once, the United States has been all but counted out by those who wanted to destroy us, only to see America rise again, bounce back, and go on. The Kremlin has no intention of taking that risk by ultimately sparing us from war. They intend to destroy the American system once and for all, and our disarmament beforehand is purely for the purpose of making their destruction of our land easy and without suffering on their own part. When ancient Carthage was destroyed, the Romans plowed salt into the ground to ensure that Carthage would never rise again. Now the Soviet Union is using the SALT treaties to ensure that America, once defeated, will never rise again. My friends, this is the legacy that America is inheriting, thanks to the totally disastrous policies which have been forced on America by the four Rockefeller brothers for decades. I have been accused on occasion of carrying on a personal vendetta against them, and sometimes against the whole family, whom I have never accused of being party to what the four brothers are doing. But it is not personal. I do not make public what I know about their personal lives, but I do believe that their policies, which affect millions of other lives, should be made public. David, Nelson, Lawrence, and John D. Rockefeller III have never done anything to me personally, but their policies have brought the land I love, the United States of America, to the brink of utter ruin. Knowing what I know, I have only two possible choices: either speak out or keep quiet, and I cannot keep quiet. To understand why I say this, you have to go through what I've gone through. You have to suffer. You have to turn over and toss at night, asking yourself, what's happened to this great country? It's always been my hope that the four Rockefeller brothers would see the light and honestly turn aside from policies which are destroying America. As a great religious leader once told their grandfather, John D. Rockefeller Sr., great wealth is a trust, and it should be used for the public good. As of now, None of the things that could be done to save America are being done. It may be too late to save America as we know it, but it is never too late to do what is right and leave the success or failure of our efforts in the hands of our Lord. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless and protect each and every one of you.